You broke it. Okay, good. Well, good. We have a lot to get through today, so it's good if you don't have a clock there and you don't get antsy or something like that. But Matt, you'll tell me when I'm like going overboard. All right, so we ended up with this, you know, kind of classic box diagram that cognitive psychologists are famous for, legendary for, right? Making some very good points in the sense of this emphasis that language isn't some singular sort of process, but that there's multiple operations going on simultaneously. Again, something we really saw in the section on perception, right, with dorsal, ventral streams and so forth. Today, though, what we really want to talk about is that, you know, what this is highlighting, what I've labeled in red here, are different types of linguistic representations, right? Phonology, the sounds of language, orthography, these arbitrary symbols that come to have linguistic meaning for us, and then this notion about a word-like representation, which is called by linguists the lexicon, lexical meaning the you know, it's just really another word for words, and then, of course, semantics, right, our conceptual knowledge of things. And so today's goal is to try to then map these different levels of representation to different regions of the brain, ask about questions about brain structure here. So that's what we're going to look at, about what neural areas are associated with these four types of linguistic representations. And I'm going to start off by talking about phonology and orthography. And actually has a long history in cognitive neuroscience, because this was actually the question asked, I think, in the very first really cognitive neuroscience brain imaging study. This was a classic study in the mid-1980s, really the first time cognitive psychologists hooked up with a radiologist and said, we got this great new toy here, and they said, we got to start with something, and they said, well, let's look at language, okay? What's the overlap? You know, how separate are the representations when I read a word versus when I listen to a word? Somehow, at some level, they end up mapping onto the same concept. But if we just do those sorts of contrasts, so that was just a passive listening test. This is the nose. These are the PET activations. And actually, it was really a surprising result. Turned out to be wrong, but got people thinking, okay? The claim was here that if you compare, again, you always have to have a control condition. So this is listening minus fixation, reading minus fixation. These were the PET activations. And the striking thing was that there was essentially no overlap between the two regions. It was as if we learn to read, we learn to speak. Once we become skilled, we develop such specialized capabilities that it's like we have two different linguistic systems, would be the inference to be made here. So again, here we're seeing in secondary auditory regions being activated when listening to words compared to just sitting there versus reading, everything was happening back in striate cortex or back in visual cortex. Moreover, notice that there's an asymmetry on the listening side of things, but actually in terms of reading, it actually was symmetric, saying that both hemispheres might have similar contributions when we look at reading. Why I say this is wrong is that people have gone back and revisited the same question, because again, it was sort of a surprising result. And it turns out that a lot of that picture they saw there about complete segregation really was somewhat special about using these very passive tasks. As soon as you introduced any sort of linguistic task, so the participant had to make some sort of response. It might not be anything necessarily linguistically related, but they had to, in a sense, increase their attention to the stimuli. You start to see a different picture. And this is just, again, just a year or two back, a retake at this. They've now made a contrast about speech versus rotated speech. So they don't just have a passive listening, you know, fixation point, but rotated speech means that they've just sort of played the sounds backwards. It's a little more complicated than that. Or here again, you're reading versus these fake fonts. So they kind of look like letters, but they don't actually spell out words. Doing the contrast here, and the point here to be made is that now when you take a new look here, now you actually start to see some areas of similarity. So especially in the anterior lobe, especially on the left side, you see a very similar pattern of activation, whether you're reading or listening. And you also start to see actually commonalities in Wernicke's area. And that's what's actually highlighted here, that now when you're reading, this superior temporal lobe activation was completely absent in that initial PET study, but you consistently see things like this during reading tasks. That is, this activation of an area that is traditionally thought of as a secondary auditory region. And in fact, people have looked at it again, trying to say, well, you know, with fMRI, we really have no temporal resolution, right? It might be that, again, the person initially, there's a segregation of the modalities, but then as we integrate the information, as we come to recognize the words, maybe now we have some sort of activation of areas that have some sort of commonality between the two modalities. So here with magnetoencephalography, right? They're going to be doing these recordings similar to EEG, but recording very small magnetic signals being generated in response to either heard words or read words. Now we can actually look at the activation pattern over time, so we get really fine temporal resolution. So this first picture is showing what's happening just 170 milliseconds, so less than a fifth of a second after the onset of the stimulus, okay? A lot of things are already happening. So signals get transmitted up to the central nervous system, up to the brain very quickly. And actually, if we look at this picture here, we actually see, again, similar to what the PET study said, initially there actually is striking segregation. So, right, secondary auditory regions bilaterally being activated, whereas the visual, reading the words, has no activation up there. It's all along that very ventral part of the visual pathway there. This is just showing the brain seen from underneath to highlight the fact that, again, on the very ventral surface, reading activates this large swatch. And now we see a striking asymmetry, right? That it's much greater in the left hemisphere, at least for reading, where it's quite different for the listening. But if we now look at two later time points, so this is another 100 milliseconds later, and this is another 100 or so milliseconds afterwards, now we again start to see that now we start to see some similarity, some sort of convergence in terms of the representations. And the main part really is that we actually see that during reading, we also start to see activation of these secondary auditory regions, the so-called verticas area. And, you know, again, it's much stronger bilateral for audition, right? You're hearing things in both ears. Whereas when you read things, you get this temporal lobe or this secondary auditory region activation, but again, mainly restricted over to the left hemisphere there. So now we actually see, again, very beautiful time course about this initial modality-specific activation. But then this asymmetry where visual information starts to converge on areas that are typically associated with phonology or with the sounds of things. So let's just blow up a little bit about orthography. And again, remember we talked about that. Orthography is about reading. So dyslexia, acquired dyslexia, is referring to, you know, a stroke that results in the inability to read. And typically it's associated with left hemisphere lesions. So despite this early claim about bilateral activation of the visual cortices, at least in terms of the pathology, it again suggests the strong left hemisphere asymmetry. And there's been lots of studies really trying to highlight, is there a specialized region, a region that seems to be really dedicated, at least in experienced readers, to the analysis of word structure, to orthography. And that's led to this discussion again about that ventral surface here, what we saw in the previous slide, what's come to be called the visual word form area. And again, it's kind of a play on, before we saw this fusiform face area, right? A region on that ventral stream that was highly specialized or recruited when viewing faces. Well, posterior to that, there's a region that seems to be especially sensitive to the presence of words, and at least words that are recognizable. And this is, again, showing that independence. So now we can do this thing. We can say, let's present the word either in the left visual field or in the right visual field, right? We know that the visual information, it's going to get projected to the contralateral hemisphere. And if we look down here in V4, right, a region we talked about earlier as being involved in visual form analysis, you see that the activation is completely contralateral, right? Notice this is sort of, I couldn't flip it around, but this is a left-right reversal here. No, actually, I'm sorry, it's not. So here we have the stimulated hemisphere field in the right side, activation completely in the left V4, stimulating the left visual field, activation completely in the right V4. So again, that contralateral activation. But now if we simply move our slices further forward, so this is a posterior slice, here's a more anterior slice, now we see that no matter which side we presented the word in, we always get the activation over in the left hemisphere. So this visual word form area seems to show this strong lateralization over to the left hemisphere. So again, here, of course, the information might be relayed directly within the hemisphere, but here there had to be some crossing of the information, probably through the corpus callosum, to actually recruit this visual word form area. And people have done all sorts of cool studies here to ask, you know, is it really special to words, for instance? And I think one of the most interesting examples is they took Canadian postal workers. And what's special about Canadian postal workers is that zip codes up in Canada aren't just numbers. They're like combinations of letters and numbers, right? So the idea is that these postal workers, having this extensive experience here reading these zip codes that both involve letters and numbers, would it actually sort of also be another type of stimulus that engages this so-called visual word form area? And that's the way it turns out to be. Well, of course, again, imaging is always, you know, a correlation, right? So people look for causality, and there's this interesting case study again. This is showing that activation in the visual word form area. And here's a person who had severe epilepsy, and they had noted that the epilepsy, the center, the origin of a lot of this seizure activity, was right in the vicinity, right? Some of the tissue that's surrounding this so-called visual word form area. So they're eventually going to go and do this resection here. They're going to take out the tissue that was basically going to remove in the left hemisphere of this individual this entire visual word form area. And so now the question is going to be, you know, does the person now develop reading problems? Of course, it wasn't clear that that would necessarily happen, because if it's been epileptic tissue, they might have had some sort of reorganization going on. But this is just showing the results here about that post-surgery, this person became basically a letter-by-letter reader. Okay, so here, what was nice is that they knew the person was slated for the surgery, so they could actually look at his performance at, you know, reading things prior to the surgery. And this is just showing that whether you have very short words, three-letter words or eight-letter words, it didn't really matter, right? He's a skilled reader. His ability to read those words was about the same speed, whether it was a short word or a long word. Okay, it didn't matter if he was reading the word, you know, cat versus elephant. Very fast reading ability. Okay, and that's what's shown here, again, either errors or in the reading rate. But here they're retesting the person either 15 days after the surgery or 6 months after surgery. In general, the surgery really impaired his reading performance. Okay, he became much slower, about twice as slow to read individual words. But more striking is also that, at least initially, it really became this laborious process where now, instead of sort of recognizing the whole word as an entity, he actually had to go through a very different route. He had to read an individual letter, one letter at a time, so that the longer the word became, the slower it was for him to read. Notice that 6 months later, he's recovered to some extent, right? He's still a slower reader, but he's losing that sort of difference between long and short words. But of course, there's actually a cost there. He really hasn't recovered this whole word reading capability because he's still making a huge number of errors. He basically has great difficulty recognizing words that are longer than four letters long. So this would be a strong argument, again, about some sort of causal contribution, right? You radically alter the person's brain structure there, remove this tissue, and he switches radically from being sort of a whole word reader to an item by item. All right, so now here I'm just sort of summarizing this idea about, you know, if we think about the neural areas associated with these two types of representations, right, we can talk about phonology, the sounds of things, and that this might really be a way to think about what Wernicke's area is all about, right? Rather than that sort of traditional emphasis that it had something to do with comprehension, it seems to be much more about the phonological structure of language, okay, the speech sound. So again, it's part of the auditory system, but it's a part of the auditory system that's been sort of, in a sense, recruited for something that's so fundamental for, you know, human cognition, our ability to sort of engage in speech comprehension. And so again, we see it includes the Wernicke's area, especially on the left hemisphere, whereas orthography, the traditional model, I don't put it up again, it really talked about the dorsal stream being important for reading, and that was based on, well, various sorts of lesion observations. But a very different picture has emerged from fMRI, which says that it's really along this ventral stream that we start to see these different regions of specialization, right? The visual face, the fusiform face area, and another part of the fusiform cortex that seems to be especially sensitive to word forms. Well, this has led to, you know, interesting questions about what about cross-linguistic differences, because there are differences between cultures, not necessarily in the way we acquire spoken language. That seems to be universal, wired into our brains. At a certain time, we're going to become sensitive to speech sounds. At another stage of development, we're going to be able to start producing those speech sounds. Of course, the sounds we produce in here are tailored by the individual accent, you know, by the specific languages. You know, some languages have more vowels than others. Different consonants exist in certain languages. So there's a developmental period there where it's going to shape the phonological representational structure. But in terms of reading, there are striking differences between languages. And here's just a contrast, say, between English and Italian. So you guys should be congratulated. You've really mastered one of the hardest languages to learn to read. Okay? English has this really complex mapping between orthography and phonology, right? There's, you know, we have 26 letters in the alphabet, but, you know, we know that each letter can have, or many of the letters can take on different sounds. And if you add it all up, there's really about 120 mappings in there, okay, right? In a particular context, one letter will sound different and so forth. So you've had to, in a sense, learn this very complex mapping, but there is a cost to it. First of all, it was harder for you to learn to read, say, than compared to an Italian child. And the rates of developmental dyslexia are really high in English for English speakers. You know, estimates somewhere between 5-15% of kids are labeled as having some sort of delayed reading capability there, despite, again, supposedly fairly normal cognitive abilities in other domains. Now, if you grew up in Italy, though, life's a lot easier, okay? 26, there's really only this very much smaller mapping system there, and there's a real consequence of it. All children, the claim is that you really don't see the kinds of dyslexia that we talk about in this country, or at least the incidence rates or the challenges of learning to read. Everyone learns to read in about 6 months. In fact, in some of these countries that have this very perfect mapping, they actually have rules that say don't teach kids to read while they're in kindergarten. It's not necessary. You don't have to worry about giving Johnny a little head start. Wait until they're in first grade because they're going to master it really quickly, and we're going to be able to keep everyone sort of on the same progression there. So again, there are probably individuals who have difficulty reading, but it's in a much subtler way because there's such a simple mapping, and so the reported rate of dyslexia is about half that you see in English. So that's led people to ask the question, well, what's different here, right? So we can now do that cross-cultural study, right? In the scanner, we can simply say, let's take Italian readers, English readers, scan them, and see what's different between their two brains, all right? So here's what you see if you get reading minus rest. All right, you see lots of activation, stronger on the left hemisphere. Again, you'd actually see some ventral activation in that visual word form area, but lots of activation also. Again, in fMRI, we're integrating over a lot of time, and we've already seen that over time you're going to get this recruitment of these secondary auditory regions, especially in the left hemisphere. Plus, you also get some activation in Broca's area and premotor cortex and so forth, regions associated with the articulation of speech. All right. Now, this is a picture for all subjects there, if we compare them simply to rest. But what are going to be our predictions if we're now going to do the contrast? We're going to say, let's compare our English speakers to our Italian speakers. What regions might we expect to show stronger activation in the English speakers compared to the Italians, and conversely, in the Italian speakers compared to the English speakers? Okay? So give me a prediction based on what we've just heard about dyslexia and so forth.
In readers of Italian, because it seems to be easier.
Okay. Right, there's a perfectly reasonable starting prediction. If reading is just much simpler for those Italian speakers, you know, then maybe their brains are going to actually show general reduction in overall level of activation. Reading just takes less effort on their part. Okay? That would be one possible prediction. What else? Okay, maybe more areas are being used by English speakers. Again, that's a variant on this, the idea that it takes more effort for an English speaker, so there might be broader activation. All right, yeah.
I think the Italians will activate the phonological area more.
Okay, so that's a very specific prediction here, right? So now you're going back to the behavior and saying, well, the Italians, okay, they're actually going to show stronger activation in the phonological regions. Because, and again, the task is simply reading. It's always reading. But the idea is because they always have this mapping there. Is that's the notion. Whereas English speakers might need to actually use this orthographic representation to a greater extent. Other predictions, yeah. Okay, so again, that's actually a variant here. You've elaborated upon it, but you're also pointing out that the English speakers might need to have a greater reliance on this visual word form area because they can't trust their phonology in a sense. And that is what the picture looks like, okay? This is, again, showing that contrast. Notice, actually, and there is, as you said, a bit in the Broca's area, too, but if we look at what areas are more active in the English speakers compared to the Italians, and of course, they're always reading their own language, you see this really large increase in activation of the visual word form area in the English speakers. The Italian speakers, well, they're much, you know, the differences aren't as marked, maybe again, perhaps because it's easier for Italians to read than for English speakers to read. But the only difference that does persist is in the secondary auditory region. And again, this fits with the idea that for Italians, right, they basically can have this perfect mapping between what they get down here and what's over here, so they can rely on the phonology. Whereas the English speakers, there are so many violations in our orthographic phonological map that basically when we read, it's almost as if we actually get interference if we actually get this recruitment of the phonological regions, right? It might actually lead us to mispronounce the words or misidentify the words. All right, so let's move on now to the lexicon. All right. Jeez, class is going really slow today. All right. So again, we're just sort of moving up here. And, you know, this is kind of a messy literature, and it hasn't really sorted its way out. But one thing that's been noted is that you can get this category specificity in anomia, right? So we already saw this in agnosia. There, of course, it was very specific to the visual modality, right? People had trouble recognizing living things versus non-living things. But within the world of anomia, right, the woman we saw the other day, you were seeing that she really had trouble identifying tools. Well, in her case, actually, if I showed you video clips of other things, she consistently has an anomia. But there are cases described such as this particular individual, right? This person, you showed me the line drawings, photographs, real objects of all sorts of categories, vehicles, toys, tools, animals, and so forth. They're essentially perfect, right? So they don't really exhibit any anomia. But then you have this one fairly restricted category, okay? It's kind of bizarre, fruits and vegetables, okay? And suddenly, the person drops down to chance. Again, something we always see is that the more sparse the stimulus, right, line drawings compared to the real objects, the more pronounced the deficit is. So you give them more contextual information, they get better. But even when you give them the real objects, there's still a huge difference between their ability to name fruits and vegetables, right? I mean, again, it's very similar to what we saw the woman. She looks at a person who looks at a picture of an apple. It's not like they don't come up with anything. They clearly have a lot of knowledge about what the thing is, but coming up with that specific name is where the stumbling block is, and you see this category specificity. Now, of course, that isn't the only specificity you have. You actually see other cases, and this is just, again, an analysis about asking about the lexicon, about how is there a relationship between where brain damage is and the kinds of category specificity you have. And so basically what they're doing is they're going to divide these patient groups. So these are all going to be patients who have lesions of the left temporal lobe, again, frequently associated with anomia. Though as we saw last week, you can also have anomia with lesions in frontal lobe or parietal lobe. But these are individuals all have lesions in the left temporal lobe. And they're just basically saying we're going to give them a big battery of words to name. We're just going to score their errors, their percent correct. So a high number here, 100%, would mean they're perfect there. So people are going to make errors, but they're going to have lots and lots of pictures here. But they're just basically saying, if you have a lesion in the anterior region, what's your distribution of errors? So these folks up here, on average, get the animals and tools right over 95% of the time or so. But if you ask them to name people, they actually start to have great difficulty here. Okay? Whereas if we actually take people who have temporal lobe lesions, but they're more medial, now you see that, well, actually, relative to the other groups, they did poorest on the animal condition. And, you know, at least compared to here, they did better than these folks on the persons and so forth. And if we get to the most posterior lesions, now we see that it's actually the tool category that's relatively most impaired. All right? So again, this would fit with the idea that you might get these category-specific problems, right? That is, depending on where the primary pathology is within the temporal lobe, it's going to have some predictability about which kinds of things you're going to have the greatest anomia on. In some cases, you get the striking contrast, perfect in some categories, real big impairment in others. But for most individuals, you get more of these graded sorts of impairments. They aren't perfect, but the problem becomes more pronounced for a particular type of category. And so the notion is, and this is just, again, showing that you take normal individuals and you have them name different things. You simply do the naming task while they're in the scanner. You also see a similar shift. It doesn't mean that if I'm naming tools, it's only back here, but there's a relatively greater activation in the posterior regions, and as we shift to naming people, you get the shift towards the front. So, again, if you look at this and think that this is sort of a reflection of the lexicon, we'd see that it seems to encompass the extent of the temporal lobe, but some sort of clustering. There's some greater similarity between, say, two different people than there is, say, between a person and a tool. And the neural organization is reflecting that sort of lexical space or semantic space. That is capturing that there's, again, some organization. The brain sort of encompass that sort of organization there. Now, a debate here has centered about, you know, is this better to think of that it's really a lexical problem about coming up with the names of things, or is it actually also a conceptual problem? And that's still getting sorted out. In these cases, the claim usually is, though, again, if you have anomia, like we saw in the woman with the videotape, right? There's lots of evidence that, in her case at least, that she does have fairly intact conceptual knowledge. And that's why the emphasis is really on the actual lexical axis. What's the label we give to that individual item? All right, and I've just added that to our list here. So the last part, then, is to ask about, well, what about the neural basis of semantic knowledge, right? That conceptual knowledge we talk about. And, you know, again, there's a recent movement to talk about that really this left temporal lobe isn't maybe just about the lexicon, but maybe it really reflects something about our semantic knowledge, our linguistic knowledge about what things are. And this is associated with the fact that there are certain types of dementia that seem to selectively target the temporal lobes. And it's in these individuals that you really start to see a so-called semantic dementia, where gradually their sort of knowledge of the concepts of things, about what things are or what tools are used for, seems to radically deteriorate beyond the point of just a problem in terms of naming the objects. So it is possible that we could think about this left temporal lobe not so much in terms of the lexicon, but maybe more about the semantics itself. On the other hand, it could be that the lexicon, the label we give to something like a hammer, is really an essential pointer to that semantic knowledge, right? And so that if we lose those lexical representations in the temporal lobe, that is the names of things, then it may make it much more difficult to actually access that semantic knowledge, even if it's actually not in, you know, localized to one particular brain region. Did you
For the people who have this dementia, do they start getting anomia too, or do they just lose the
dementia? They always have an anomia, right? So there's, I don't know of any cases where a person really shows a loss of the conceptual knowledge but can still name the things. And again, that's what you also see in aging, right? It's really hard. And you can think about it this way, right? I mean, next slide makes that picture, that story, right? Right, here is our picture we had in the memory section about, you know, the consolidation hypothesis, right? That our memory for something is this broadly distributed representation, right? We had this idea that before learning, they all had to interact through the hippocampus. But again, here we want to emphasize after learning, right? This is the picture I gave you about that there isn't a single site for any one memory, but it's this composite of this broadly distributed representation. Well, what does it mean to have this long-term memory that's broadly distributed? Well, this is our conceptual knowledge, right? Gave you that Golden Boy pizzeria example where I can tell you all these things, what it smells like, where it's located, you know, what the arrangement is within it. Well, the idea is that I'm drawing on all this information. Well, that's my conceptual knowledge of A, what a pizzeria looks like in particular, and what the Golden Boy looks like specifically. So again, I'd really argue that, again, this distributed semantic knowledge really kind of maps on to the way we think about how long-term memory gets formed, because that is what conceptual knowledge is, and also this business that we've already talked about before, about these category-specific effects that you can have about different types of representations being selectively abolished. So again, with these individuals with the dementia there, we don't actually ever see people who are losing their concepts but still have the word notions. And if we take this sort of as our picture of this is conceptual knowledge, and maybe the labels are up here in a sense, well, you could see why it would mean that you sort of have to have a case where a person's had broad atrophy across the whole cerebral cortex with sparing within the temporal lobe. That's the kind of picture where a person would actually be able to name something but might have lost their conceptual knowledge. But if you'd lost your conceptual knowledge and I held up a hammer, you know, how would you know how to map that onto a particular item in the lexicon without actually being able to draw on this sort of long-term knowledge? So again, I don't think you'd ever really see that reverse case there.
It would just be like very basic shape recognition.
Yeah, that's right. They probably still have something like that, but they wouldn't be able to come up with the name, and they also would have lost that sort of semantic knowledge and that conceptual knowledge there.
Has it been shown ever if you give them the hammer, do they know what to do with it, or is it completely gone?
These people with semantic dementia. I don't know. I'm betting so, and I'm betting that they would do fairly well, okay? I mean, again, if we think about with the semantic dementias, you know, like with Alzheimer's, the primary pathology tends to be up here
and so forth. But with these patients who, again, they're classified by their syndromes as semantic dementia,
There, if you do the scans, you find they have really prominent atrophy down here. So if we think about that, again, we talked about dorsal and ventral. Like, this is sort of the vision for action system. Then you'd expect that if I really had marked atrophy down here, relatively little atrophy up here, that they'd actually still have a lot of capability about using something, even though they'd have difficulty expressing what it was about or coming up with the name of it. So that'd be my prediction, but I have to go back and see if people have actually done that test. Yeah?
How would you make a behavioral distinction between like anomia combined with like loss of semantic knowledge from, like, say, object recognition problems? Like, what is the difference there?
Yeah, so again, with an anomic, they're going to have a problem if I sit there and say, name the tool you would use if you wanted to pound a nail into a piece of wood. They'd be stuck, you know, it's not a saw, it's a, you know, they wouldn't come up with the word hammer. So it wouldn't matter how I gave them the information, whether I showed them a picture and said name it, or I gave them an oral description. In both cases, they're going to have trouble coming up with the name. So that's going to be the basic distinction about, is it, say, an agnosia or is it an anomia? It's that modality independence is with the anomia. That if this is sort of the lexicon, then all the different modalities are converging onto that entity. And so again, you can see why, or this sort of notion is about why anomia is also so common, that if it's a much more precise representation, what's the specific name for this item compared to its broad notion, right? Well, damage here might really disrupt, you know, a fairly small cluster of neurons that are dedicated to the representation of the label we give to this concept. But we still might have a lot of that conceptual knowledge, because even if we have some disruption in the, you know, these regions up here, we still have enough probably to actually give us some of the conceptual knowledge. You do get interesting dissociations. It's not as though, again, the conceptual knowledge, and we've already talked about this category of specificity, but here's just another example. We could show a person, say, a picture like this, and we can ask two different things. We can probe their conceptual knowledge about, you know, what is it? What is this creature? Some sort of stork. Or we can ask something about what does it do. I don't know if it does a particular thing, but, you know, maybe it fishes and so forth. So you can give that sort of question. And this is just a contrast of two different patients here. One with a large lesion that included temporal lobe, but also some posterior parietal lobe. Boswell was the way it was referred to. Very different patient, though. So here they're just trying to make a distinction between, suppose I have a lesion anterior versus a lesion more posterior. So this is a frontal lesion, more of a posterior lesion. And again, you can get these interesting double dissociations, okay? So this particular patient, and of course, we'd be wary about single case studies here, but this one here, the point being made is that if you ask him what it is, okay, name what that object is, has great difficulty. But if you ask this other question about what does it do, so he'll say something like, oh, bird, or wouldn't give you any sort of specificity there, or might even, you know, come up with, just say animal and so forth. But then you ask the question, you know, what does it do? Does really well at those sorts of things. Whereas this other patient, who has the more anterior lesions, shows the reverse pattern, right? Able to name the things, tell you what it is, but has great difficulty telling you the actions associated with it. So again, that would fit in with the notion that a lot of our conceptual knowledge about what things are probably involves these anterior regions, these motoric-oriented regions, whereas, again, the temporal lobe here might be more about naming the particular entity and so forth. This does lead to this question about, well, if we're going to think about, you know, our conceptual knowledge, what are the organizational principles of semantics? That is, how is that reflected in the brain? And so in language, right, the, you know, what do they teach you in, I don't know, fourth grade or something like that? They teach you about, well, how is language organized? It's organized by word classes, right? You have nouns and you have adjectives and you have verbs, and you have to, you know, things have to be marked in terms of what category they belong to, and that's what syntax is all about, and then you put the thing together. But a different way to think about it is that maybe it's more of a conceptual-based orientation, right? That maybe we have sort of action-oriented things, again, reflecting that our concepts of actions might engage these motoric regions versus our non-action-oriented. So how do you test that between those two ideas? And here's just one example. Okay, they're going to look at TMS over the motor cortex, right? Remember, when we do TMS over motor cortex, we aren't really trying to disrupt the motor cortex. They're just using it as a probe on the excitability of the motor system. And they're going to measure then these motor evoked potentials in the muscle. So they're basically going to give a TMS pulse, measure the motor evoked potential there, If it's a large motor picture, they're going to say, look, the motor cortex has been activated. It's in a heightened state of excitability. If I have low motor potentials, then the motor cortex is in a quiet state of excitability. And of course, in our basic task here, the people are just reading words, so we'd expect that overall it's a fairly low level of excitability. The person's not actually making any movements. But they're going to have these two independent variables, right, the kinds of things you like to create on your exams, right? One is going to be that they're going to compare verbs and nouns. The other one is they're going to cross that with things that either denote actions or things that sort of denote non-actions. And so, of course, the idea is that I can separate my verbs and nouns, you know, these two hypotheses I just mentioned, in terms of independently manipulating the variables, right? So I can have verbs that either refer to actions or non-actions, but even within the category of nouns, I can come up with nouns that actually refer to actions versus ones that refer to non-actions. So that's going to be the four conditions that they're going to test, and they're going to look at the motor evoked potentials when people are reading either of these different words. Interesting aside is that it's really hard to come up with a lot of nouns that actually aren't also verbs, right? Like word like hammer can be both a noun and a verb. And that's actually the evolution of language, that things go that way, that things become nouns, but eventually they become a verb. We like to turn them into actions, right? You all Google nowadays, right? That's an example about this verbification of language. Well, here's the results. And they clearly suggest, actually, that it's really about, well, maybe you have both main effects here. But you clearly have, whether it's a noun or a verb, you have heightened, this is again, this proxy measure of the excitability of the motor cortex. So again, up here means that you have a heightened excitability of the motor cortex, down here a lower excitability. So overall, the verbs do produce a more pronounced effect than the nouns. So that would be consistent with this word class organization. But then even within that, we actually see this other effect, that within each of those two classes, if it's an action-oriented item, you get another boost in terms of the excitability of the motor cortex. So you could say this is one of those sort of unsatisfying things that it didn't rule out one hypothesis and clearly come down in favor of the other. It actually says that both organizational principles might be reflected in sort of our semantic organization, that there's some general clustering about nouns activating the motor cortex, even if we're talking about these abstract nouns like a door. But the way we adore something might have some reference to some other action that's more explicitly a movement. So we have this general advantage of our increased excitability for verbs versus nouns. But then within there, we also see this greater enhancement of the motor excitability when we're actually talking about action-oriented items. All right, so just to add that to the picture here, we've seen fairly specific neural regions associated with these types of representations. But when we come down to semantics, really the emphasis is much more about a distributed representation. So where am I on time? All right, keep going. So to this point, though, I've really talked about, left hemisphere and language functions. But there's always the question about, well, what about the right hemisphere? You know, and the classic view was that, you know, it's the non-linguistic hemisphere. It's about spatial reasoning, or it's kind of the mute hemisphere, or something that's called the dumb hemisphere, and so forth. And there are, you know, again, questions about that. If you ask, you know, if you give a person an injection that puts one hemisphere to sleep, this is sometimes done as part of a pre-surgical procedure, you will see that if you give a barbiturate injection to the left hemisphere, the patient will immediately stop talking. They typically do something like this. They have their hands up. They're going 10, 9, 8, 7. They time it so that the barbiturate hits right at a particular number, like at the number 7. Okay, the person goes 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 6, 5, 4. They have a slight stumble, but if you inject it in the right hemisphere, the barbiturate, left hand falls down, right? They've lost control of the right motor cortex, but they keep on speaking, and you can actually give them items to remember, speak to them, they can communicate with you. You do the reverse, though. Person sitting there, give the injection, hand comes down, and immediately they go silent, okay? And if you ask them afterwards, you know, what did I say to you during that window there, a few minutes and so forth, they have no recollection of it at all. So that, again, favored this notion about that the right hemisphere really had very little linguistic function. But lots of studies with split brain patients have said, well, there are some at least limited lexical access in the right hemisphere. So here's a case, again, where the person, you know, is groping different objects here, or they're seeing the different words. And you might actually get some cases where they'll be able to name things, at least if they're concrete objects. So There was an argument that, again, they didn't maybe have abstract linguistic capabilities in the right hemisphere, but at least for concrete items, you actually had some capability. But I've done a fair amount of research involving these colostomy patients, and one thing that's always struck me, we sit down to do the experiment, and, you know, we're always going to do something like you're going to do this with your right hand and this with your left hand. We're going to have some of the stimuli on the right side of the screen, some on the left side of the screen. When we tell them how to do these tasks, we actually use words, okay? And it's always been a puzzle, like, how can we sit there and simply tell the person, all right, you're going to see dots on the left side of the screen, and if it's on top, press this key. If it's on the bottom, press this key. If these guys aren't, you know, able to verbally communicate with the right hemisphere, right, we just simply give them the verbal instructions. We don't have to get up there and pantomime it or move their hand to the different locations. You can just give the verbal descriptions there. So, again, this is just sort of anecdotal, but I think there's various lines of evidence that really suggest that there's actually a lot of linguistic competence, at least on the comprehension side of things, in the right hemisphere, that we really should think about semantics as being strongly lateralized to one hemisphere or the other. So I just modify this picture to make that emphasis here that at least in terms of semantic knowledge, we really need to think about bilateral sort of representations here. And then the question comes about, so where does the asymmetries really come about? And actually, we've seen in orthography there is a strong lateralization. Less clear in terms of phonology, certainly in terms of the lexicon, but a lot of the asymmetry is probably much more at the output side of things. It's really about speech production that seems to be strongly left lateralized, involving these anterior speech regions or anterior language regions. And again, I mentioned this, I think, before, is that there's a lot of interest in this notion about that maybe you really needed to have strongly lateralized output there, because in speech, right, we're using both sides of the body, right? And I reach to something, I can reach with the right arm or the left arm, but to actually use my articulators, I have to actually use both halves of the speech system there, and I might need to have restricted control on one side of the brain so that I don't have to sort of integrate the activity across the two different hemispheres to produce coherent speech. Indeed, people have talked about that individuals who show bilateral speech representation, they tend to stutter quite often, that there's some sort of conflict between the two. So I just throw this picture up. I'm not going to really talk about this, that we certainly see on speech these sort of left hemisphere regions, syntax, a bit unclear. But there are other aspects of language, what they call paralinguistic things, like prosody, and here there actually tends to be much more of a right hemisphere involvement. So prosody is referring to something like I can say something to my kid like, you know, you going out tonight? Or I can say, you going out tonight? You know, I can vary, I can use the same words, but put different inflection in my speech and be conveying very different meanings. So that's what I mean by paralinguistic. The words themselves aren't going to discriminate between those two different sentences. It's something about the intonation of my speech, where I can be asking questions, making statements, indicating anger, and so forth. And it's really the patients with right hemisphere lesions who both show problems in the production of prosodic cues. They tend to speak in a very flat tone and also have impairments on the perceptual end. I didn't assign it, but if you want to read the chapter about hemispheric asymmetries, that talks about that in greater length there, about some of the computational reasons that the right hemisphere might be associated with prosodic aspects of language. Here I just want to point out that it really is a simplistic observation to say that language solely involves the left hemisphere. I'm sure there's a tremendous amount of linguistic competence, both on comprehension, but also some of these paralinguistic cues that seem to emphasize the right hemisphere. All right, so finally, I want to just say a few things about bilingualism. Okay, this is, you know, a real puzzling thing, right? So we've sort of laid out some of the neural structures that are involved in the representation of a language. But what about if we have two languages, right? One of these gifted individuals. Of course, there's two different types of bilinguals. There's those who, you know, their first language, their introduction to language was bilingual, where they have two different languages being spoken to them. But then there's also a lot of people who acquire, you know, a second language, or people acquire three, four, five languages and so forth. And so the question is that people have been, you know, pondering is that at what level of representation is this distinction made between, you know, how we represent one language versus a second language, all right? So is there some sort of distinct neural representation? And if so, right, it's likely at a level below semantics. Presumably, you know, what's the word for a table in Italian? What?
Tavolo.
Tavolo. Okay, so if Lou hears that word, table or tavolo, presumably she has the same sort of semantic representation being activated. Possible that it's different, but, you know, seems reasonable. But it, obviously at some level there's got to be different words marking these two things. So people have tried to, you know, look at this in the lesion literature. Are there individuals who have strokes that selectively abolish one language and not the other? And occasionally you get case reports, but there's really no clear description, you know, that so-and-so had a stroke and suddenly couldn't speak French, but could continue to speak English. A different way to look at that is to look at these brain stimulation methods. Again, during the surgery, these are candidates who are, you know, up for surgery. Of course, some of them are bilinguals, so they can do stimulation. They can do it across the temporal lobe, frontal lobe, and they can simply ask the question, let's say the person's reading, for instance, is there a place where we'll suddenly disrupt their ability to read? So they're actually reading out loud, or they could be reading silently and they probe their memory later on. And they're just going to ask, can we stimulate someplace? And this is just showing that in this particular study, this is like a large group study of bilinguals, again, looking at the effects of brain stimulation. So they actually identified out of a few thousand stimulation sites, 200 sites where they actually could produce some sort of disruption with reading. So again, the person's going along reading, turn on the stimulator, suddenly they become mute, turn it off, they keep on reading and so forth. Once they've identified that region, they can then say, are they selective to one language or another? So they stick up the words that are in one language, you know, or reading words from a different language. And they actually found here that 13 of these 201 sites were language specific. And that's what they emphasize in this paper, that yes, here indeed we do see that there's a segregation, a separation of the lexicon. Right? We can disrupt reading of a particular word in one language, and yet the person's unimpaired reading that same word or same concept in a different language. But again, what you really don't know with this sort of study is, you know, well, what's the test-retest reliability, right? You don't get much time with these patients. So suppose I turn on the stimulation and they can't read it in one language. What they don't ever do in these studies is then turn it off and then say, now I'm going to turn it on the stimulator again, but ask them to do the exact same task over again. And it might be that one time the person does poorly, one time they do well. We don't really know that question. So just seeing that there are some sites that show a difference seems to be very weak evidence to say that we really have a strong segregation at the lexical level here. There is a lot of functional imaging work on this, and the bottom picture is that it's a lot of overlap. I think I want to skip this part here. But there's also been some interesting structural work where people want to ask, you know, are there structural differences in the brains between people who are polylingual or bilingual compared to people who speak a single language? And this is an interesting recent report saying that if you actually scan the brains of individuals who are bilingual, you have some bilingual, some monolingual, or we can also look at things like their proficiency in a second language, right? You can be bilingual to different degrees, or we can look at the age at which you acquired it. Well, this study is reporting that you actually see this enlarged gray matter in the brain. Surprisingly, it's in the intraparietal region, but it's all in the left hemisphere on people who are bilingual. All right. So again, this is another one of these sort of skill acquisition things. Think about a second language as acquiring a new skill, and you see that there's some sort of neural correlate. If you want to build up your gray matter, you know, go out and learn a second language and so forth. And in terms of this maybe being causally related to their bilingual proficiency, they're showing that the greater that increase in the gray matter density, so right, gray matter is all the cell bodies, the more proficient you are in the second language. So these guys, you know, they're kind of like me on French, just uttering a few words. These are kind of your fluent speakers, and you can see that the ones who are showing the largest gray matter density increase are the ones who are most proficient, and you can actually independently relate that to at what age did they acquire the language. So these are the folks who, you know, again, acquired two languages simultaneously. These are the ones who acquired it late in life. And you can see that the extent of that gray matter enlargement there. So why the inferior left parietal lobe? And, you know, pick up this paper. These guys, they scanned the brain. They didn't have a priori hypotheses. They just said, let's scan the whole brain of these people. We'll compare bilinguals to monolinguals. We'll see what correlates with proficiency and so forth. Now you got the result, right? They might have thought if in advance, oh, it's going to be a bigger temporal lobe or something. But they got this result, and then they kind of come up with this idea. They say, well, you know, it's kind of important here about fluency, about switching between two languages. Parietal lobes been associated with those sorts of functions about attentional shifting and so forth. So maybe this is something that's allowing you to generalize, you know, this fluency between languages. The last point that I want to make is that earlier on, we talked about this juggling study that did the same thing, said what part of the brain changes when you learn to juggle. And it turns out, they don't actually talk about, but it's the exact same region, all right? So that's the puzzle I leave you with, really, is, you know, what's similar about learning to juggle and learning a second language that's going to produce the exact same changes? Or is it actually something about this part of the brain is very malleable? Or is there something common about these two different functions there? All right. So review today, 4:45, 5:101.